Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome back to No Smoke Without Fire. This is part four, The Green King. And the first thing I'd like to say to the audience today is thank you very, very much for all the wonderful comments that we've had in about this series. I know Debbie's going to be very pleased because she has done by far and away the lion's share of the research that we're using in these discussions. But it's been really good to see that we've got an audience which is engaging, and a number of people have said to me, you've really got us thinking. We thought we knew about the royal family and we didn't know these things, and now we're starting to research ourselves. And that's got to be a huge compliment for the UK column, because we've always said, don't just believe us, do your own research. So Debbie, welcome. And yeah, isn't it lovely to have some good feedback from the audience on this one?
Do you know, it absolutely is. And thank you, Brian, for that, because, you know, this is what we're here for. We're not here to tell anybody anything. And we always say, don't we, don't trust us. Don't trust me. You need to trust yourself. So all we try to do is to find the signposts and show our audience and let our audience make up their own minds. And I've been really encouraged by so many messages of support saying, wow, you know, we're thinking again now, we're looking a little bit deeper. And that's exactly what the whole aim is to encourage people to look for themselves and make up their own minds. And my goodness, you know, today we're going to bring up some subjects that we're only going to be able to scratch the tip of the ice of. They are huge, huge subjects. And this time as well, I think I want people to remember during the last 4 years how we've watched our friends, family, neighbours, if you like, too, in Australia, in New Zealand and in Canada be really very badly hit with the whole COVID agenda. We've seen so many issues with lockdowns, terrible lockdowns in Australia and New Zealand. And we've now got the MAID system going on in Canada. So there's an attachment there. So, you know, watch out in this episode of No Smoke. And we might be able to join a few more dots.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, we're going to start, I think, with a statue, an image. So
well, we finished with
take
this.
Us away.
Well, we finished with this statue, I think, last time, and loads of people have said to me, oh my goodness, whatever was that? Is that real? And the answer is that yes, this is real. And this was a life-size statue depicting Prince Charles saving the world, wearing nothing but a loincloth and a pair of wings. So I thought, right, well, we'll show you some photographs in a little bit more detail, so that, because the other photograph last time wasn't so clear, but clearly you can see that. And if you go to the next slide, you see that I've zoomed in on the top of the statue, so you can see that it's Prince Charles, as was then, now King Charles, his face, wearing a loincloth with his angels, and it's cast in bronze. And then the following slide will show you the base of the statue, which is Prince then Charles standing on a hill of skulls. You can probably see a crucifix buried there, top left. So I just wanted viewers to see the statue close up, because I'd had so many messages about, oh, this can't be real, this surely isn't real, but it is. And it was presented, a small size of the statue was presented to Prince Charles in Brazil, and the sculpture was somebody called Mauricio Bentes, and he was commissioned to sculpt this bronze. Now, it's extraordinary, really, because I've looked everywhere for information on this particular sculptor, and there's very, very little. But interestingly, the sculpture of the little one was presented to Prince Charles in 2002. And Mauricio Bentes died at the early age of 45 in 2003, little over a year after he'd presented the sculpture. So the one sculpture is at the moment in an Amazonian town in Palmas, the capital of Tocantin, which is on the edge of the Brazilian rainforest. So it really does exist.
Yeah, and of course he was shown this. Do you approve of this? Are you happy? And I find this incredible that the man is portrayed as an angel, or and quite clearly the loincloth, there is something inherently religious about it. But he's presented this as though he is what? One of God's angels? And he's happy with this. I find this incredible. What normal person? We're going to represent you as I'm going to say an angel of light in the first instance, and his ego is such that he's delighted that this is the case.
100%. I mean, he absolutely was delighted to receive it, and he's got his own statue. Presumably at Highgrove House or Clarence House or wherever it sits now, I don't know. There's this particular statue as well in the Brazilian rainforest. And author Tim Cohen, who's done a lot of research on the monarchy and Charles, he suggests that there is a much bigger statue that measures 10 cubits, which is biblically relevant, which will be placed on top of the third temple when it is built. So that's what I've heard. I don't know whether that's true or not. But again, this is something that our readers and viewers can take and research further and make up their own minds.
Yeah. Okay. So where do we go on from there? Because the main point we've been making is that we've got these two parallel streams with King Charles, one of which is a clear belief that he's descended from the kings of Israel. We'll talk about that a little bit more in today's episode. But at the same time, he's absolutely engaging. He's one of the lead people in matters to do with Gaia Earth and the World Economic Forum and sustainable development and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So it's quite bizarre. On one hand, there's a push towards Christianity, in inverted commas, and in parallel with that, he's going towards the green earth, the mother goddess, Gaia.
Yeah, and he's not just going towards that, but he's wanting to recreate a new planet, a new earth. He wants to rewild, reseed, and turn everything back to before we polluted it, basically. And, you know, in that sense, you have to think to yourself, well, you've just seen the statue, Saviour of the World. He professes, really, by Astra Carta and Terra Carta, to be king of the world, but he is king of the Commonwealth. And the Commonwealth is something that we don't really take a lot of notice of. And it was strange because I was only thinking the other day, I went to school in London, and one of our annual trips, and we always used to get excited about just going on the coach and getting out of school, but it was always to the Commonwealth Institute. You know, as kids, we were taken there every single year to the Commonwealth Institute, which now no longer exists. However, people don't really talk much about the Commonwealth. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how King Charles and the Commonwealth maybe morphs into something that we're going to see in a minute, which is a super Commonwealth. So I've just got a little bit of video to remind us of what is the Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth is a collection of 54 countries that are home to 2.5 billion people. That's almost a third of the world. That total also includes 19 African countries. It's a young organisation. 60% of the Commonwealth population is under the age of 30. The modern Commonwealth was formed in 1949 although at that time it had 8 members, and only one, South Africa, was on the continent. Initially, all members of the Commonwealth were former British colonies. Mozambique was the first country without a British colonial past to join in 1995, followed by Rwanda in 2009. The Commonwealth says to join, you need to share the values of the Commonwealth Charter, adopted in 2012. These include democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. So what happens when a country is accused of breaking these commitments? South Africa removed itself in 1964 after pressure from member states about its racist apartheid policies and only rejoined in 1994. Other countries to have left and then come back include Nigeria and Gambia. Zimbabwe withdrew in 2003 for breaking the Commonwealth Charter under former President Robert Mugabe and have yet to be readmitted. Supporters say it helps countries to develop and work together on international goals. Some say, though, that it's a legacy of Britain's colonial past and doesn't have any power. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex, that's Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, said in July that the Commonwealth must acknowledge its past, even if it's uncomfortable. The head of the Commonwealth is Harry's grandma, Queen Elizabeth II. The organisation is led day by day by the Secretary General. She is currently Patricia Scotland, its first female head. We'll meet her in a moment. The Commonwealth meets every 2 years to discuss their plans. They were meant to meet in Rwanda in 2020, but this has been delayed due to the pandemic. You might also have heard of the Commonwealth Games. This is a massive sporting event that takes place every 4 years, featuring athletes from all the Commonwealth countries.
So well, that was just to remind you a little bit. And of course, that was prior to King Charles becoming King Charles. But yeah.
Well, I just smiled as I watched it because it was suitably cartoonish and it had the nice little beaty music in the background to lull you into the alpha state, I think it's called. But yeah, to join, you've got a democracy, human rights and law. The three areas that have completely collapsed in UK, but as far as the monarchy's concerned, that system's still going and we can draw in these innocent little African countries. I'm being pretty cynical here, but I think it's true.
Yeah, and I picked up too the targeting again of young people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Young blood, young people again. And when you look further into the Commonwealth, obviously, all you can see is sustainable goals. You know, it's the big agenda, sustainable goals, and all the countries that are involved there. You can see sustainable goals in the Commonwealth. That's from the Commonwealth website. And then you can see some of the countries that are involved very heavily in this sustainable goals. You might have to zoom in to see them all. But you know, this is a massive agenda. And you can see the UK clearly down there. And every single country has its own agenda, has its own guidance. And I just picked out the UK's, which was the latest one was 2019. But if you go to the website and you're a Commonwealth country, then you can pick out your guidance. And this was the Voluntary National Review of Progress Towards the Sustainable Development of goals back in 2019, and you can see all the goals there. Yep. In the little colours. And
Debbie, just got to come in there. Brian. Fascinating how they can just strap the word voluntary in front of it, because this agenda coming in isn't voluntary at all, because most people have absolutely no idea what's in the pipeline. But the people who've produced that document, let's put voluntary in front of it as if everybody has agreed. The cynicism and the arrogance of these people is utterly breathtaking.
Yeah, it is. And this is all going on behind closed doors, you know, because no one's taking... Everyone's so busy looking at the WEF, the WHO, NATO, NASA, all the rest of them. People forget to look at the Commonwealth, which is what I wanted to focus on. And that document relating to the United Kingdom just to give you an example of who it's written by, the foreword was actually written by the none other than Rory Stewart.
He was known as Florence of Arabia in Westminster because of his past. Was it Afghanistan? I think he walked across a big chunk. Fair enough for that. But the rest of his flouncy time around Westminster, they called him Florence of Arabia. Sorry, a little bit of black humour.
No, it's not a good look. But he actually said, you know, the goals are the five P's. And the five P's are people, planet, prosperity, peace. We're going to hear a lot about peace and security, peace and partnership. So people, planet, prosperity, peace and partnership from Rory Stewart. But the action on the goals for the UK, and as I say, everybody can go to their own country's agenda and you can see it. But for the goals for the UK, it's a huge document. It's about 180 pages. So I literally just took this as an example to show you of what they're looking at. No poverty, and we're living in a cost of living crisis and no one can afford to pay their mortgages or their energy bills. Zero hunger, and we've got shipping disruptions and all sorts of food crises and food security going on.
The one that catches my eye is that peace comes after prosperity, when my calculating brain would say, well, if you've got peace, you've got a much better chance of achieving prosperity or any other of the goals there. But no, peace is just a sort of minor consideration. Is that because they know that in the world they're creating, there's unlikely to be peace? And as long as they're making the money, the prosperity, that's fine.
Well, I think everything's inverted. So if they say peace, they mean war. You know, if the government tell you something's safe, it's dangerous. If they tell you that something is trustworthy, it probably isn't. If they tell you it's the truth, it's probably a lie. So, you know, peace to me intimates war.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
But I mean, sorry, Brian.
I wouldn't disagree with that, because I've said before, if you don't understand what's happening around you, try inverting what the policy, what they say is happening, choose the opposite and you'll be closer to what the policy really is. So I think we're in agreement on that one.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, a couple of episodes ago, we saw that it was recently the King, just before his cancer diagnosis, he gave, or I think it was a couple of days after, but he gave a Commonwealth speech. But I just want to, for this one, we won't play that again. Just want to remind our viewers and listeners of the relevance of King Charles to the Commonwealth and what he envisages for the future.
I want to say clearly, as I have said before, that each member's constitutional arrangement, as republic or monarchy, is purely a matter for each member country to decide. The benefit of long life brings me the experience that arrangements such as these can change calmly and without rancor.
There you have it. King Charles obviously feels that any country that wants to leave the Commonwealth, that's absolutely up to them. He's insisting that whilst he is the overarching, what word am I trying to look for here, Brian?
He's trying to say the
cornerstone of the Commonwealth, if you like, the person that heads it. Actually, he's saying, no, each country is ruled itself. So actually, you know, it's all fine. But I don't know what you took from that, but I can see another agenda unfolding.
Well, what I picked up straight away was that he said Commonwealth realms are all sovereign states. And then his final statement was, these arrangements can change. But it was said very gently, very quietly, very gently at the end. So having said, yeah, it's fine, you can all be yourselves, you've got a state, it might be a monarchy or it could be a republic, boom, boom, boom. But all these things can change. And that's because the intention is that they will change, because where they're heading is a global system of government, where I suggest this man thinks that he's going to be the spiritual guru.
Well, that's very astute. And I was wondering if you'd pick up on that, because actually I hadn't said that word because I was hoping you might, and change. And that's exactly spot on, Brian. And the way that he said it was very, very quiet and very unassuming. And I think we need to take note of that, because things are changing, and I'll show you how. I mean, but just to confirm, you know, the King and the Commonwealth. So we've got King Charles heading the Commonwealth. There you see him, sovereign of 14 Commonwealth realms, in addition to the UK. And he's also head of the Commonwealth itself, a voluntary association of 56 independent countries. So we know that King Charles is in charge of the Commonwealth. And right at the beginning, especially to our viewers and listeners in Commonwealth countries, specifically New Zealand, Canada, Australia, and the UK, now's the time to listen up, because I'd like to introduce you to what I'm calling, and it's just my words, it's simply my opinion, of what I believe is to become a super Commonwealth. And this is in the form of something called KANZUK International. And I've done quite a bit of research on this, but basically it was founded in January 2015 as the world's leading advocacy organization promoting facilitated migration, free trade, and foreign policy coordination between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. That there you get the KANZUK International. But I've been looking in depth at KANZUK, and I've uncovered a few very interesting things. What do you make of it, Brian?
Well, what I picked up in that last slide, you've got to read the small print, of course. Our campaign advocates closer cooperation between these four nations so they may build upon existing economic, diplomatic, and institutional ties to forge a cohesive alliance of nation states with a truly global outlook, global. And then it says our proposal is to ensure that Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK not only sustain economic prosperity, but develop travel and employment opportunities for each of their citizens as part of a global initiative. But then I love this one, our work. Now, you just ask yourself who our, to whom that refers. Our work has been recognized by senior government officials and diplomats across the world. And we have engaged millions of citizens within these countries to support and campaign for our proposals. The arrogance is truly astonishing, because the reality is that the overwhelming number of civilian people in civil society, civilians, have no clue about these policies. So what he's really saying is that our think tanks and powerful non-government organisations have done a brilliant job at pulling the wool over the eyes of people. So they think they want our proposals. But of course, he doesn't actually say what the real proposals are.
No, I know. I mean, honestly, it's staggering when you see, and I mean, we're going to explore further, but I've selected a little bit of video. It's just over 3 minutes long, but hold on to your seats because I'd like to introduce you, if you haven't already been introduced, to Kanzuk International. Enjoy.
Kanzuk is a diplomatic alliance between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, promoting reciprocal migration, free trade, and foreign policy cooperation between these countries. Although reciprocal migration and free trade would promote economic growth, prosperity, and opportunity amongst the four nations, foreign policy cooperation would increase military and defense collaboration between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. But how would this function, and why would it be beneficial for Kanzuk and the world? Relations between the Kanzuk countries are exceptionally close, as each have a long tradition of mutual defense cooperation through training, operations, and ministerial discussions. By implementing a Kanzuk defense agreement, such cooperation would increase significantly, creating a military alliance of like-minded, sovereign nations with a tremendous presence on the international stage. Firstly, the Kanzuk countries are geographically positioned to rapidly deploy operations in either the Atlantic or Pacific Oceans, ensuring the safeguard of sea lanes, trading routes, and offshore territories across the world. Given their locations, and by engaging in closer operations, the Kanzuk countries would have a formidable presence to ensure international peace and security. And with a combined military budget of over $110 billion, it would be the third largest military power in the world, larger than Russia or any of the EU countries. Secondly, as Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK collaborate together as part of the already existing Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, the implementation of a Kanzuk defense agreement would ensure the effective development of signals, military, and human intelligence, advancing public safety and national security across the four countries. Not to mention, with authoritarian governments across the world seeking greater power and influence, a Kanzuk defense alliance would provide a united front in deterring hostile military actions, preventing adversarial action via air, land, or sea, and eliminating threats of war, cyber attacks, and terrorism. Finally, with the United Kingdom occupying a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council, a Kanzuk military and defense alliance would afford Canada, Australia, and New Zealand representation on this council, providing a stronger, unified voice for these countries and ensuring mutual values of peace and democracy are advocated in all future discussions. As a Kanzuk military and defense alliance would consist of four like-minded nations working together as sovereign forces, the benefits would be astounding. Closer military operations would ensure the preservance of international peace, while greater defense and intelligence collaboration would mean a safer and more secure world for all. Overall, an alliance of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom would not only propel these countries from regional to international powers, it would be a trusted and progressive force for good in the world, providing peace and international security for generations to come. For more information about Kanzuk and details on how to join our campaign, join us on social media, or visit us online at kanzuk.com.
Wow. You saw me bury my head halfway through that, because that's the first time I've actually viewed that clip. And we could just stop the rest of our episode here and concentrate on that. I mean, truly astonishing. I just love the casual reciprocal migration at the beginning. So, oh, that's interesting. No more UK. We're simply just a shared land space with Canada and New Zealand and Australia. But of course, that means economic growth. No substance or evidence to support that that idea. And then what's the rest of it to do with? Well, it's military to try and prop up the decayed UK military infrastructure and make us look as though we're a capable military unit together with those countries so that we've still got some power to throw around in the United Nations. I mean, it's truly a story. I can now understand, Debbie, why you've been smiling and cackling for a few days, because you said this is just mind-blowing, and it is. And it's going to cause peace and prosperity, presumably in the same way that NATO has created world peace for many years. There's no wars going on at the moment, nobody being slaughtered in Ukraine. So
peace means war and prosperity means poverty. So you're looking at war and poverty, not peace and prosperity. And the thing is with Kanzuk is that, it really is. And I did say at the beginning, you know, we're going to touch on subjects that we're just scraping the tip of the iceberg, because Kanzuk, if anybody wants to go and search Kanzuk and Kanzuk International, they've got their own website, and there's plenty of little YouTubes on their YouTube channel as well. But if you want to go and look at, put in a reference to Kanzuk and politicians, you see all our politicians standing up in Parliament talking about Kanzuk. And this is just to give you a flavour of what's on their website. So you can see Rishi Sunak there. You can see they're talking about polling Australians, Canada's digital synergy, Australia introduces changes to visa programmes. These are just a few of the subjects. I mean, the website is an absolute feast to behold. So go and have a look and dig down into it and see what else you can find.
And the thought of Trudeau getting closer to the UK, I wouldn't want him very close to me at all, but the thought of him coming closer to UK and he's having squidgy little meetings with Rishi. I mean, what are these boys talking about? We had Obama creeping in and out of Westminster a few days ago. Nobody ever told why he was there. And what horrible deals or plots will be Trudeau cooking up?
I don't know. We've got Mark Carney as well, Canada. We've got Sir John Bell, Professor Regis Sir John Bell, Canadian. So you can see, you look back over the last 4 years and there have been such huge links between the UK, New Zealand, Australia and Canada. And I know the US has been going through a very turbulent time, as have Europe. But there have been similarities always between the four countries. But have a look and see who's running Kanzuk International, Brian. Have a look and see the executive directors. I think you haven't seen this before, so it's interesting getting your reaction.
This is the beauty of No Smoke Without Fire, you see. It's very impromptu, and we can do all these things, have these wonderful discussions on screen. Well, we've got a James Skinner. He's the founder. Now, that young man is not very old, in my opinion. I don't know what you would guess at, but early 40s.
Yeah.
And he's just said, I've got a good idea. We're gonna draw UK, Australia, Canada and New Zealand together. It's my idea. I'm gonna become chief executive. This is ridiculous. He's some puppet place person that's been put in there. So he was born in South Wales, in the UK. Well, I'm glad they defined that, because I could have gone to the other side of the world. Educated at Kent School in Connecticut, USA, before attending Cardiff University. So this man is already seen as a globalist. He's had a globalist education. He's not content with having nationality in South Wales or UK or Wales. He's become an internationalist. And then he worked with governments around the world, including the US Congressional Office in Florida, the Australian Senate in Canberra, and the Houses of Parliament in London, UK. And he currently resides in Toronto. So this is a special individual. And I can guarantee that he was selected and groomed by one of the many think tank type organizations that set up what he says he founded. We've got John Bender. He's chairman. He's chairman of Matthew Bender & Co. Holdings Limited. So I think that's something to do with money. an investment office associated with one of the founding families of a FTSE 100 publishing concern. I'm always wary when they don't want to name the businesses which they've been involved in. Between 1988 and 2001, he worked at Morgan Stanley, Barings and Coutts. So this is an international banker. And he served as a special advisor to the Prince of Wales Charities Office between 2004 and 2014, as well as councillor of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, and chairman of the Conservative Party Discussion Group. Well, how you find them, Debbie, is quite remarkable. And the last one at the bottom of the screen is Nigel Greenwood, an Australian political writer and former senior analyst in the Australian government. In the 1990s, he wrote a civil libertarian defence of the Crown in the Westminster system, arguing against the Australian Republican Initiative. Wow. So he must be a favoured man of King Charles III.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, that's just the executive board. Let's run through quickly the advisors, because, you know, Kanzac International need advice. So who are they? Who's on their advisory board? I'll let you do the honours, Brian.
Sir Michael served as Vice Lord Lieutenant Greater London, as distinguished service career, serving as board member of the National Bank of Kuwait. Oh, it's another banker. Former director of the Westminster Forum, an honorary society for the Pilgrim Society. Now, that's an interesting little organisation, which takes my mind back many, many years. That's for another time. We've got Stephen Klimczuk Massian, who's a corporate strategist, scenario planner, board member, foundation director, published author, and sometime Oxford University fellow. He's Harvard MBA, based on Vancouver Island, and he's currently serving as a senior advisor to one of the world's largest management consultancies, not named, where he was previously a principal and head of his think tank for CEOs and prime ministers. So he trains prime ministers. That's brilliant. Yes. So he's worked with Bain & Company and Goldman Sachs, so it's another banker, and head of strategy for legendary investor Sir John Templeton's main family philanthropy. I'm not getting warm vibes out of these people at all. They're bankers.
No, exactly. And there's more. I mean, there are another three slides of their advisory board. Right, I don't know if you want to go quickly
well,
through
why not?
All three.
Let's pick a few more out.
It gets worse.
We've got Derek Gosselin, special advisor for EU affairs. So that makes sense. So we're pushing the EU out through the Commonwealth, but we're pulling them in case they get lost. So he's chairman of the European Corporate Security Association, vice chairman of NATO's von Karman Institute, cabinet office secretary for the Flemish prime minister, former chairman of the Belgian advisors on trade, former chairman of the ASEAN Commission of UNIS. We've got the Right Honourable Lord Johnson of Lainstone, CBE, member of the Advisory Board, member of the UK House of Lords, founding partner and chief executive of Somerset Capital Management. That's a hedge fund. Prior to that, he was with Robert Fleming and Jardine Fleming. That's banking in Hong Kong. And he was appointed vice chairman of the Conservative Party. Oh, my goodness, what a surprise. With special responsibility for business engagement in the party's finances. So anybody that's ever wondered about the Conservative Party, never, ever forget, of course, that in the money that they took were a large number of Russians who got out of Russia pretty quickly before Putin sorted them out as we attempted to privatise Russia. And they're popping up in other places. I digress. Let's pop on to the next one. And we've got John Petrie, OBE, Special Advisor for Commonwealth Affairs. My goodness, is Windsor Herald at the College of Arms, the heraldic authority for most of the Commonwealth realms, Councillor of the City of London, Advisor to the government, Governor General of Antigua and Barbuda. He previously worked as a senior advisor at the Bank of England. Oh, and served as UK's representative on the Statistics Committee of the European Central Bank. Well, he gets around a bit. And we've also got Andrew Lillico. He's looking a little bit sinister there. Senior Economics Advisor, a Principal at Europe Economics, Fellow of the Institute of Economic Affairs, the IEA Monetary Policy Committee, Chairman of Economists for Britain and Vote Leave, frequent contributor in the UK and international media on economic and financial matters, including on programmes such as Newsnight, Today programmes, Sky News, CNBC and Bloomberg. So he's the media man to make sure that they get the best coverage. My goodness, what a busy little group of individuals.
But aren't they
but
just?
Really, we could stop here because, you know, they've declared that at the end of the day, everything they're doing is in our best interest. They just want us all to be happy and well-fed, possibly with enough water to drink. And we can just leave the world to them.
Yeah, why not? But, you know, so far we've covered, you remember King Charles, we were looking at charities, we were looking at insurance, we've been looking at the little funding streams and banks and hedge funds. So we've got a nice little nest going there, but we need a couple more people to make the circle complete. So a couple more advisors there for you, Brian.
Well, I'm really glad that you brought these up because the circle, as you say, is now completing because now we've got matters spiritual. We've done the let's make a big buck out of the whole thing. Now we've got let's get the spiritual side sorted out. So we've got Noel Cox. Now, he's a barrister. But he's also an Anglican priest in New Zealand. That's a pretty interesting combination, judging by the state of law and order in New Zealand and the UK. Head of the Department of Law and Criminology at Aberystwyth University. Major field of research interest is aspects of the Crown Estate. Now, he's got to be a privileged individual because I'd imagine that you're not going to stick your nose into the business of the Crown Estate without somebody watching you pretty quickly. And he's published all around the world, particularly Canada, Australia, New Zealand. He's the author of 14 books and 150 other works. But there he is as the Anglican priest. And we've got Roy Eppen. He's a specialist physician. So we've got spiritual and we've got the health aspect and we've got the bankers. Have I picked up this right? I know what you're doing, Debbie. You're giving me a testing in front of a live audience to see whether I can correctly pick up on all this stuff.
No, spot on. You know, you look back at the previous No Smokes and you see where the funding streams are coming. And if you're going to have a super Commonwealth, because let's keep it back with King Charles, because he is the king of the Commonwealth. If you're going to have a super Commonwealth, then King Charles is going to be head of the super Commonwealth. And what better than to have advisors in your super Commonwealth on all of those areas and those funding streams that you rely on for your sustainable goals. Now, I might be joining too many dots, I don't know. But, you know, Brian, we've had the advisors, we've got the executive board. How about support for CANZUC? Let's see where the support lies for CANZUC.
We'll do this quickly. We've got Kerry Lynn Findlay, Member of Parliament, South Surrey, White Rock, Canada. Tony Abbott, former Prime Minister of Australia. Always useful to have a sort of old Prime Minister. Oh, we have Boris Johnson, former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, one of the most trustworthy Prime Ministers that UK's ever had. And of course, everywhere he's been has functioned perfectly. Judith Collins, Member of Parliament for Papakura, New Zealand. And I'm not impressed with the supporters.
Yeah. Exactly. And what you've then got to figure is if all of these people are cooking up this massive, great, big, as I call it, super Commonwealth with Australia, New Zealand, UK and Canada, then who else is going to be interested in it? Because they're professing they're going to be a global superpower to match Russia, to match China. This is the whole thing. When the UK left Europe, the European Union, all of a sudden now we've got to become a global superpower. So who are we going to pal up with? Well, the Commonwealth is the obvious choice. But how will other countries benefit from CANZUC. And in the times that we're living at the moment, I think it's interesting to look at this article in the Jerusalem Post, who is talking about how Israel will, or what Israel will gain if CANZUC succeeds. And quite clearly, Israel will gain a lot, as we'll go on to see in the next few slides.
Yes, this one is fascinating. I pick up there the comment on that slide, which sort of says, well, Israel's very pleased at this because they've been getting a bit of a rough ride from the European Union. And I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe a little while ago, but as far as the slaughter that's going on in Gaza, Israel is being fully supported by members of the European Union. So presumably Israel thinks the Israeli state, let's just qualify it a little bit, thinks that they're going to get a very, very friendly welcome from this new arrangement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, again, the king is sealing the deal, as it were. And in the article, there was this picture posted of Prince Charles, obviously now he's monarch, meeting President Isaac Herzog at Highgrove House in 2021. So the wheels are very, very much in motion. But if we go on further, I mean, I'll let you go on further into the article, because it gets very interesting as to how Israel, or why Israel, would benefit by the friendship with CANZUC International.
It says eminent British historian Professor Andrew Roberts believes that the CANZUC countries should form a new federation based upon free trade, free movement of people, mutual defence and a limited but effective confederal political structure. He points out that were CANZUC to become a union, it would immediately become one of the great global powers alongside America, the EU and China. It would easily be the largest country on the planet, having a combined population of 129 million, the third biggest economy and the third biggest defense budget. Are they talking about the largest country on the planet by land mass? That's what the inference is, I think,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And of course, let's not forget Israel is only a little country and they are looking for friends at the moment. They've got quite a few enemies at the moment.
It goes on to say that the CANZUC countries already have a common head of state in the British monarch, a majority language, legal systems based on Magna Carta and the common law, the Westminster parliamentary tradition, and a long history of working together. What they lack is geographical proximity, which Robert points out, is becoming less and less important in the modern world. I could have almost believed it if he'd said they've got a problem geographic separation, but we've got a plan to fix that. We're going to bring them closer together. Sorry, that's my black humour for the audience, but you remember these people think they can do everything, including miracles. So it says, what would CANZUC's attitudes towards Israel be? Suppose the third major political force as envisaged by Roberts were indeed to emerge on the world stage. What might be its attitude towards Israel? Judging by Israel's current relationship with the countries involved, the connection would certainly be considerably warmer than the wary and arm's length association between Israel and the EU. Stronger, though, that has become in recent years. It would be boosted by thriving Jewish communities in all four CANZUC nations. So this is not about the benefit of the existing nations within the proposed CANZUC agreement. This is about the benefit of Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about, you know, the geographical positioning of CANZUC, because one of the big agendas for CANZUC is GPS, global positioning systems. So they can track and trace everyone in Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. We're sort of ideally placed in the middle. And of course, Mossad, Israel, you know, it's
and the shared intelligence services.
Really big nest.
the shared intelligence services, which of course Francis Maude from the Conservative Party revealed several years ago, how we were going to be intimately, British security services, GCHQ, were going to be intimately connected, working in partnership with Israeli security services, including their infamous 8200 unit 8200. And this has continued.
Thriving Jewish communities as
well. We now have a memorandum of understanding with Israel running.
And all of these countries have got thriving Jewish communities, and that is to be seized upon. So that's really relevant as well. But it's not just Israel, Brian. Kanzak have got their eyes on other places. And like I say, we're just scraping the tip of the iceberg here, because I'm sure when our viewers and listeners, hopefully, will do a bit more deep diving and they'll come up with loads more information. And if you do, please send it on, because this whole the Green King, no smoke, is getting bigger and bigger and all the time. But clearly here in the next paper, you can see a reference to Kanzak and Hong Kong, would you believe? So we've got big ambitions.
Yes, that I pause for that one, because in my mind, somebody recently was saying that they had seen something, they'd read something. They said this to me, that they'd seen something, read something that was almost as if UK was making an approach to get Hong Kong back under British control. And it was a sort of throwaway little comment, but I distinctly remember something. So that's fascinating to see that Hong Kong would be there. There's something I just want to say, that we've mentioned the connection with Israel, and obviously the text that we've had on screen is talking about the Jewish community, Jewish communities in UK and Canada and New Zealand and Australia. But we have a great many Jewish people around the world who are themselves warning about what they see as political dangers between Western nations and Israel as a state itself. So we don't want this misinterpreted. We are simply pointing out the facts and who said what. And at the end of the day, I think that members of the Jewish community should be as concerned as we are with what we see building. And I'm going to say at this point, this far into your Green King, David, what do I see this? This is the building of another power block to move us towards a one world government system. That's what I think we're looking at here.
Spot on. I completely agree. And I think it's interesting that the mention of the thriving Jewish communities was actually referenced in the Jerusalem Chronicle. So, you know, that's where those words came from, that article. But, you know, clearly this is the next, or what they're planning to be, the next superpower for the New World Order. I can't see any other intention other than that.
Yes. Okay. Well, I got an advantage over the audience because I can see the next text that we're going to bring up on screen. So as part of the article, I take it this abstract forms part of that.
The Hong Kong, yes.
Yes. So let's read this, because this is amazing. It says, with the deteriorating political situation in Hong Kong in recent years, some measures have been imposed on China by Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, Kanzak. These have included a joint statement to condemn China and providing a route for Hong Kongers to emigrate. This paper takes Hong Kong as an example to explain how Britain can reconnect the Commonwealth by taking a leading role in defending democracy and freedom under the post-Brexit Global Britain banner. This paper argues that Kanzak's actions on Hong Kong can be extended to the Commonwealth, as this is not without precedence. This is utterly incredible. Are they seriously saying everybody from Hong Kong should simply migrate over to one of the Kanzak countries?
And well, that's what I'm taking from it.
Yeah, that's what I think. Debbie, it's incredible because in my head are 1,001 questions to ask and comments to be made. But we are seeing something pretty impressive being built here. And King Charles, once again, is at the forefront of this, the Commonwealth. And we know, indeed, from speaking to people in Commonwealth countries, particularly African countries, how many of them see this glowing image of UK as a land of green fields and justice and care and harmony, law, order, all the things we know don't exist, they think are here in bucketfuls. And the Commonwealth is going to be used for this vehicle to control. What was the figure that came up earlier on? Was it 2.3 billion people or 2.8? I can't remember. But it was a lot of people within the Commonwealth. And as you picked up, they're all youngsters. So this is incredible. And then we've got the spiritual aspect with it.
There's more on that, you know. And when we first embarked on this No Smoke, Brian, and the Green King, we envisaged maybe a couple of episodes, didn't we? We didn't really envisage so many. And again, you know, today we've covered the Commonwealth and looking at the super Commonwealth, that's what I've called it. But what we're going to be looking at next time, just to give a little teaser to people, and if you've stayed with us this long, thank you so much for staying with us, because the next episode of No Smoke is going to be people-based, and who does the king surround himself with? And I think, again, you're going to find that there are some people that you may not even have heard of, but are performing and have performed significant roles in the agenda moving forward and the agenda now. So I think to everybody, if you've stayed with us this long, thank you so much.
Yes, there's more. There's a lot more coming. Now, before we let the audience go, because they're not allowed to go without permission, it's funny how things happen, but when the coronation was taking place, and I was very curious about what was going on, and I know you were, Debbie. All of the ritual, this is all very well, the pomp, the ceremony, the ritual is all very well, but what was going on? We were never really told. And then you found articles in Jewish press, which were actually talking a lot about the coronation. And I just wanted to say that out of some old material I had, I found this little booklet, and it's 1952 to 2002, explaining the Jubilee, its biblical significance and meaning. And I started to flick through it. And then I find in the middle of this little book on the Jubilee, it was talking about the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. And it says, I have to put my glasses on here, as we look back in this Jubilee year of the Queen's accession to the throne, we shall discover many links between Britain and the Holy Land, and a series of parallels between our very British coronation service and the manner in which the ancient kings of Israel were crowned in Old Testament times. We must ask ourselves why this should be so. And then it goes on to talk about the night before the coronation, all the regalia, the crowns, the scepter, the gowns, the orb, the bracelets are brought from the Tower of London and stored overnight in the Jerusalem chamber in Westminster Abbey. And this has been the custom for centuries. And then it says, there are two outstanding features of the Jerusalem chamber. Firstly, the walls of the Jerusalem chamber are panelled in cedar wood that came from Lebanon, the same type of cedar trees that supplied the timber for Solomon's temple. Second, there is a tapestry in this chamber that depicts a scene entitled The Judgment of Solomon. Solomon brought Israel to the peak of her glory and fame prior to her fall into disgrace, division, and scattering. Now, I'm not going to do any more of this today, but I am going to say there was a fascinating amount of detail in here, which has never, to my knowledge, appeared in the British press, and certainly didn't appear in the press around the time of the coronation. But if you want to know more about this little book, it was printed by the British Israel World Federation. And this is essentially the British Israel movement. We're going to be doing more on all this. At the same time, I kind of hold this one up because it's slightly green in colour and that causes a problem. But this is a little book and it says British Israelism Examined. And this other book, which has got a good amount of analysis in it, is warning against the belief system that the first little pamphlet put around the crowning of Charles. But I think the one thing I get out of it very clearly is Charles thinks he's been crowned king of the earth. That's how I see it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because where you were reading there and you were saying about what went on the night before the coronation, well, in the next episode of No Smoke, I'm going to be revealing what went on before the night of King Charles's coronation. And it might not be what you're expecting.
Well, we'll leave it there. What a great taster for the next one. So, Debbie, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining me again. It's always fun to do these. And I got to say well done for the incredible amount of research that you do and are continuing to do. Digging into this one, because we really need to talk about this, because what's coming is nothing to do with love and peace. It's something very, very different. Let's end there with a smile, and we'll say to the audience, do join us for the next episode. It'll be fun to have you back. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.